What's going on, Warrior Soul family? This is Chris Albert, and this is another episode of the Warrior Soul podcast. You know, in this day and age, we are getting more and more information every day about things that can help to improve performance. And it's interesting because we see all these advancements in athletics. We see these advancements in holistic medicine. But when it comes to treatment of our veterans in the VA system, there is always one single answer that seems to be given by doctors, and that's pharmaceuticals. Well, today's guests, we have Emily Hightower and Josh Lindstrom. Emily is a yoga, breathing, and nutrition specialist who works with challenged athletes to help to enhance their performance. And Josh Lindstrom is a retired Green Beret who suffered a traumatic brain injury, who works with veterans to try to help them to gain a better mindset through sports. And basically what they've done is they've created these amazing breathing and mindfulness techniques. And this is the thing for most veterans. Most veterans don't want to sit in the middle of a room doing yoga and doing breathing exercises without doing anything else. But what they've been able to do is they've been able to adapt these techniques to helping people with specific sports. And I think that's an amazing thing because it helps the person who's trying to do it to focus on something that they love. And through the practice of doing this sport, this craft that they're trying to master, they're basically also centering themselves and allowing themselves to get the benefits of mindfulness and breathing. Most notably, they've adapted this to archery, and they've been taking veterans through archery classes that help to adapt these breathing techniques and help them to become better shooters. It's a really great podcast. Josh and Emily have some really awesome opinions on the state of veterans' health in this country today. And we get a lot into that in this conversation. They're also both great people. And you'll get to see that throughout this conversation. Before we get into the interview, I want to give you an announcement from our amazing sponsors, F-Bomb Nutrition. You can find them at www.dropanfbomb.com. Now, what do? They make amazing, delicious, healthy packets of fat. Now, this is so helpful if you're a person who's doing the ketogenic diet or doing a high-fat diet or a paleo diet for that matter. They've got these awesome packets of MCT oil, coconut oil, avocado oil, and olive oil. But what I really like are their fuel packets. Now, the fuel packets, they contain some amazing, awesome nectar of the gods type goodness. They've got this one, it's coconut oil mixed with macadamia, not coconut oil, coconut butter mixed with macadamia nut butter. And it tastes like a macadamia nut cookie crushed up into a packet, and it's readily available and it doesn't have any sugar in it. I use these all the time. Absolutely amazing product. Now, if you're out there and this interests you, you can head over to www.dropanfbomb.com, and they're giving 20% off to Warrior Soul listeners on their first order. And you can get that by using the code Warrior Soul at checkout. 20% off for some delicious, awesome, high-fat, low-carb snacks. And with that, let's get into this episode of the Warrior Soul podcast with Emily Hightower and Josh Lindstrom.
This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
What is going on, everybody? This is Chris Albert with the Warrior Soul Podcast. And we've got a multi-screen show for you today. I'm joined today by Emily Hightower and Josh Lindstrom. And they're from an organization called Guerrilla Holistic. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Good. Josh is there. He's like, I'm good, man. I'm good. So first things first, I want to talk to the audience about what you guys do, where you come from, and how you got started. So can you guys give me the story here?
Yeah. Well, basically, I started working with Challenge Aspen 17 years ago. They're an organization here that works with providing possibilities for people with all kinds of physical and cognitive challenges. So after the incidents of 9/11 and as the Gulf War took charge, we had a lot more needs in the veteran population. So we've really anchored into what's called CAMO, Challenge Aspen Military Opportunities. And that's where I provide breathwork coaching and nutrition and yoga therapy. So that's how I met Josh Lindstrom last year.
Which sounds like the absolute last place you would meet me. So I was a former 10th group. I actually knew Andrew Marr in the Q course. And, you know, ended up getting blown up in 2012, medically retiring from that. And had gone on this retreat with Challenge Aspen. It was a ski retreat with the SOCOM Military Adaptive Sports Program. And we had to do a breath workshop at the end of one of the days of skiing. And, I breathe all day. Mm-hmm. So I figured, you know, what could I possibly learn about breathing? And we went into this yoga studio, which, I mean, you can picture me in a yoga studio. Emily started to give her class, and about 5 minutes in, I realized that there was a whole world of things that I had not considered in terms of how to improve performance. And, you know, later discovered, you know, through talking to her, she helped coach me. So we did the class, and I asked her to coach me for an hour with my archery, which is what I'm big into archery now. And she agreed. I didn't know. She drove an hour to give me an hour class at 6 a.m. just on breathing and archery. She's never been an archer or never coached archery. She's just good person, good friend, agrees to do it. I didn't know how good of a friend she's going to end up being, you know, but I thought she lived right down valley anyway. So she coaches me. I go home and I shoot the best score I've shot ever at that time, you know, by a large margin. And it just kind of clicked that there was this whole path that I had not explored in terms of performance. And, you know, she kept coaching me and still does. And we ended up, what was really her vision to do this archery breath retreat. I, you know, agreed to do it and not really thinking much was going to come of it. And she pretty much put it together, invited 7 wounded veterans out to Aspen to this archery camp, which turned out to be this great way to teach and practice breathing and, you know, all the things that I found in the therapy of shooting, you know, in specific regards to head injuries, mainly, you know, learning coordination, fixing the balance system, you know, really doing therapy for the eyes, all the parts that are damaged in the TBI, I believe are improved in the archery. And so, you know, both things just take a ton of time and, you know, After that realization of what she had to offer, you know, I dove in as headlong as I could.
You know, it's amazing to me because breath work is something we all have access to. And I've had so many experts who've come on to this show. You know, we've had Brian McKenzie on, we've had Patrick McCune. We've had a lot of people come out and talking about the Wim Hof method and, you know, for me, breathing's been important to different aspects of my life throughout my life, right? So when I was in the Marine Corps, it was really important for marksmanship, right? It's really important for shooting, and that's like the center of it. And then, when I got into powerlifting, breathing was so important for powerlifting and making sure that you were able to control your breath through the lift. And it actually would determine whether or not your lift was successful or not. Mm-hmm. Now I'm into jujitsu and martial arts. And again, so important. Emily, when you approach these types of issues with breath work, do you find that you can walk up to somebody and say, okay, you know, breathing is going to be such an important part of you, such an important part of who you are? Or do you need something like external, like the archery? Does it help to introduce the discipline to it?
Oh, it's a great question. I think having something to focus on is the meal ticket to getting people to breathe correctly. If you ask people to sit, as we found out in our archery retreat, you know, to sit down and do a long extended breath training, you have to have a lot of buy-in before you try that. And for most people, it takes something that's going to give them a metric to see how successful they are when they start to add the breath. I mean, could you feel that in your power lifts when you weren't breathing correctly versus when you were? That's extremely motivating to learn more about breathing and to make sure you're doing it correctly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the physiology is endless. The science behind breath for things like, I know you're super into the ketogenic diet, and that's been an incredible part of Josh's healing path, just learning more about traumatic brain injury and inflammation. The breath on the exhale is also when you trigger fat burning metabolism, but only if you're breathing diaphragmatically and if you're bringing the breath all the way down into the belly. So there are ways that you can apply breath to digestion, to performance, to focus, to kind of exploit the breath to help with acute things like anxiety or insomnia. And it's just fun to be working with someone like Josh, who uses it for something like archery, where he can actually see the result, you know, every day. And then when he's having a bad day, he has breath tools now to get back on track. So
Josh, is this something that you've introduced to your daily routine? Is it mostly when you're practicing archery, or is it something you just do at will?
So that's a great question. It's kind of a long answer, because I kind of wanted to get into that, like how I found breathing and why I think it's so important. Because, 2 years before I'd met Emily, I'd started doing some adaptive sports camps with SOCOM, and I went there and I tried the air rifle, and you know, I'm a sniper, so I'm gonna pick this thing up, I'm gonna knock it out of the park. I got a hold of that thing and it looked like I was shooting a machine gun, and I could not come to terms with that. So I would have to lay down and breathe for 10 minutes, and I wasn't thinking meditating. I was just like, if I don't calm myself down, I can't quite do this the way I need to do it. And that drove me to start the adaptive sports, drove me to start exploring. And you gotta forgive me here. I forget what I'm talking about sometimes.
It's all good, man.
This is, you know, you gotta reel me back in though.
Well, so the air rifle. And one thing I wanted to comment on with that, because you were talking about how you picked it up and it looked like it looked like you were shooting with a machine gun, you know, with somebody with your background, very specialized in shooting, that had to be a really hard thing. And that was probably very disruptive to your system as well. You know, it adding extra stress, causing you to breathe all over the place, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, the only time I was really finding any like calm and rest was when I was doing that type of shooting. And this is the part where I can't remember you'd asked a question just on your last.
How do you incorporate it into your daily discipline?
Okay. All right. Yeah. And so I remember now. So what I found was that after, you know, doing this breathing stuff, that it was useful for more than just performance in archery or shooting. It was that I was noticing the same types of breathing problems under different types of stress. And I saw that similarity. And so it bled into life in general accidentally. And that's, you know, something me and Emily, you know, talked about after we taught the first class, was a lot of coyoting, you know, giving a metric, like, you have to have a reason to do that stuff. And really the reason was to get better at archery. But what I found was, the improvements in being able to tell when, a lot of the issues that I was having with a head injury were a lot of them were mood related, which brings up another whole thing that I want to talk about. You know, when you are tasked with being homicidally angry, appropriately so, in work, and then you take the list of symptoms from a head injury, and you anger, irritability, all these, you know, the standard list of head injury symptoms that are a lot of times by the VA and military called PTSD, which I don't personally believe, having had a head injury, knowing how prolific they are, just from our own weapon systems.
Right. You know,
guys are coming out diminished, and if they've had a lot of deployments, it's almost like it's not who, it's how bad. And so having this metric to go back to and say, okay, well, this is what calm feels like, this is what I'm feeling like, how do I give me the roadmap from appropriately homicidally angry to these symptoms and where the line is? How do I figure out what that line is? What I found was that my breathing was the indicator for where that line was. So if I was breathing the same way I had been breathing in combat and then breathing under the stress of firing and then driving down the road, I knew that there was a problem, and then I had a tool to fix it.
You gotcha. Know,
having a breath work to just, you know, kind of Z my frequencies out became something that I used, still use every day, you know.
So you were literally able to tell whether or not there was going to be an issue by the way you were breathing, or you could catch yourself falling into that because you were monitoring your breathing, you were becoming more mindful of it and actually paying attention to your breath. I think that's a really important concept to address there.
Mm-hmm. It's a muscle that you exercise, and it starts to be recruited on your behalf. The more that you use it, the more you not only have it to implement in the ways you need it, but the more you'll become aware of when you're not using it correctly or to your advantage. And like the guys that we brought out for this archery breathwork camp, I don't even think we called it a breathwork camp. That was just hidden. Mm-hmm. But those degenerate groups of soldiers, you guys breathed more than
in the mountains of Aspen.
Yeah.
A group of degenerates in the mountains of Aspen.
With weapons and one yogini running around guiding breathwork. But really, you guys breathed more than any, you know, yoga retreat I've ever been on. You could go to a week-long yoga retreat in Bali to do some deep breathwork training, and you wouldn't breathe as sincerely or as frequently as these, participants in the archery camp, because they weren't necessarily trying to do the technique. It's just archery brings you into it. You cannot help but start to focus on bringing your breath awareness into your balance and into your shot process. So,
I think that's really important too, because, as Josh just mentioned, a lot of people don't really know that they have a traumatic brain injury. They don't know what kind of impact their service has done to them. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, like you said, and this is some of the important work that Andrew Marr, my good friend who's written a book on this stuff, he's brought to light the fact that, you know, our own weapon systems can give us traumatic brain injuries. That coup counter coup scenario, it happens a lot amongst our service members. And then not only that, but the poor nutrition you get, you know, we have to deal with the MREs, the amount of inflammation that comes in, that total body chronic inflammation that gets up to the brain, and that can worsen any injury that you get through that process.
Mm-hmm. You know, three things. Number one, they're finding traumatic brain injuries from the temporary cavitation of bullet wounds as far away as the abdomen. So that means you get hit with the right round, that, you know, temporary cavitation of that energy dispersing into your tissue is so damaging that it flows all the way up in your brain and damages the brain. Okay. Those are gunshots. Got friends with high drain shots about the same symptoms I'm talking about, which is the second part of the problem, is that I was just reading a National Geographic article, and they're saying there's shouting matches in the Pentagon about whether or not brain injury exists. There are neurologists on the wards at Lonsdale that didn't believe that there was such a thing as a post-concussive headache, you know? So there's this push to turn it and call it PTSD, which is, I don't know how many guys I've met. They're like, I have mental issues, you know, because they don't want to say PTSD because it's so stigmatized. And I ask, hey, were you ever, you know, hit with an IED or blown up or fire any mortars or a cannon or a tank? And they're like, every single time, they're like, yep. Which brings me to the third thing. What I'd like to do, I want to get one of those, you know, those ballistic gelatin skeletons they use on that Discovery Show channel to see who's got the sharper axe or whose karate kick is the worst. I want to get one of those. I want to put it in an MRAP, and I want to get a 60,000 frame per second camera, and I want to film it, because the people aren't going to, my prediction is that the amount of force generated by those, just the blast wave, is going to bend and compress bones in a way that I'm going to imagine is going to be nauseating. Mm-hmm. You know, bones tib fib compressing an inch when that blast wave goes through, and the bones, you know, bending at you know, a significant arc as that wave of force travels through them. And when you look at that and compare it to what, you know, causes, you know, damaging injuries physically, and then you imagine what it does to the brain, like, people won't be able to help but believe it. But right now there's a huge problem with people going around a believing because of the VA and the military saying, hey, you got PTSD, and not even acknowledging head injuries, mostly because, you know, the resolution on MRIs and fMRIs is not sharp enough to see brain damage until, and I know several guys that have been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis or multiple scarring of the brain, which is normally associated as a degenerative disease, but is being caused by this rapid compression and decompression of the gases, the injury to the tissue, and the symptoms are all, you know, very, very similar. So,
One of the interesting things that I've found is in just doing this type of work and doing the research required to do this podcast is that, you know, when you look at the clinical trials behind SSRIs, the main SSRIs that are being used to treat veterans for PTSD, if you look at the clinical trials, the efficaciousness amongst the civilian population is so-so, right? They work some of the time with civilians. They've actually never demonstrated that SSRIs or SNRIs have any efficaciousness on the veteran population. So that makes you ask a few questions. Now, are veterans biologically different than other human beings? Well, of course not, right? So then why are these drugs working on some of the civilian population but never on veterans? And, yeah. And that leads you to believe that there's an alternative explanation here, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean... So I'm going to wrap on pharmaceutical SSRIs for just a second, but when they were introduced in the 60s, they were actually tested on a population that was hospitalized. The first revision of the first copy of the DSM, Diagnostic Service Manual, is what they used to diagnose every single, you know, mental disorder, and it's what the DOD and the VA use. When they wrote that initially, they had a pretty narrow definition for major depressive disorder, and they found that SSRIs were effective on patients that had been hospitalized for depression. Now, I know a lot of guys that are injured and haven't been hospitalized for depression, but most people I know zero. What they found at that time was 70% effectivity of SSRIs on the patient population. Well, there was a 30% positive affect from the placebo, which gave you a 40% improvement. Okay, fast forward a decade, DSM-2 comes out. Now they've broadened the definition of major depressive disorder to include things like sighing loudly, kicking rocks, sad, despondent look in the eyes immediately after losing a puppy. I mean, to these ridiculous extents. And they took that non-hospitalized population, they ran the same study. What they found was they had a 40% efficacy rate on SSRIs and a 30% efficacy rate on placebo, which means that statistically they have a 10% improvement now with this broadened definition. Now, legally, that means that you can prescribe these drugs to many, many, many more people. Right now, it's 11%, I believe, the United States population is on SSRIs. And the problem with the whole thing is that I feel like switching to a tinfoil hat here, but you know, 90% of your serotonin and 70% of your dopamine are produced by the bacteria in your gut. So we are physically pruning neuroreceptors off the brain, which accept serotonin, to say that, okay, this diminished amount of serotonin that we're now receiving is enough. When really to improve the body's bioavailability of serotonin, you have to improve the gut bacteria, which goes to die. So we're treating, especially in the military, you could prevent this almost before it happens by giving soldiers a probiotic.
Right. We just had Dr. Rodney Dietert on. He wrote a book called The Human Superorganism. And that book, I highly recommend it to anybody who wants to read it. But in that book, he talks about the fact that bacteria, they're not just something that just improves our digestion. They're not just something that hangs out on our skin. They actually influence our genes. They influence our brain.
Everything.
And you have a nerve that connects directly from your brain to your gut. That's why they say we have two brains. So the bacteria in your intestinal tract can influence your brain. And if it's not right, it can cause inflammation. It could cause depression. It could cause a whole host of really nasty issues all around your body.
I'll even one up that. My current working theory, and I don't have the research budget to test this, but alcoholism, right? So we know about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I believe you've talked about it on the podcast before. Okay, yeah. I just don't want to re-educate if people already know. So the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth eats sugar, right? Alcohol is metabolized into pure sugar. It's a bacterial infection that you acquire. And the example I like to use is Native Americans. You have a population who's never developed alcohol, right? And then they are introduced to a second population with a bacteria that demands sugar. They have a diet that has no sugar in it. Okay. And then you give them a fuel source for it in the, you know, metabolized alcohol, which is essentially pure sugar. And so what I'm starting to believe is the effect of these outside organisms on the body isn't just, you know, limited to, you know, what you said, which are, you know, that kind of covers everything, but it can be, the effects can be as dramatic as like chronic alcoholism that causes death, but a perfect disease doesn't kill, you know, immediately. That one's probably the best one around. It's been hiding right under our noses for 200 years, three, four. When did we invent alcohol? You know, there's so many influences on your body that we haven't even mapped all of them.
Yeah. You got to check out that book, man. You will absolutely love it. It's The Human Superorganism, because it's like you said, that this is something that has been lying under the surface. And one of the things to remember too is that a lot of vets from our generation, you know, people who are born in the you know, late 1970s, early 1980s, mid 1980s, during that time period, people were being told that breastfeeding was bad for you, or bad for the baby. And so they were going to formula babies. And so what we had was a lot of what Dr. Dietert would call incomplete human beings, because we're not just our mammalian genes. He actually says that 99% of our genes come from that bacterial influence. And what happens is if you're not giving the baby the probiotics through those, through breastfeeding and through vaginal birth, then a lot of times that baby will develop chronic disease problems. And what you have to understand about traumatic brain injury is that it's not just the initial injury, it's the inflammation that comes afterwards. And so if we don't have that defense mechanism to heal that inflammation, then things are just going to get worse.
You just made me think, like, so if a woman has a baby through C-section, you're supposed to take some of the amniotic fluid and like splash in the face of the baby? Or, I mean, maybe it's that easy. Like, how do you fix that?
It's a whole nother big topic, but there's a whole lot more than the amniotic fluid that happens there. I only know this because I'm a mama, but it's, you know, dealing with the effects of what we have now with so many people that are C-section babies or not breastfed or that are eating the standard American diet. And, you know, there's just these two pieces of the education and then the positive interventions that you can take to influence the result. And the positive interventions take time and they take training. And that's where we're all trying to come in with, you know, not just prevention, but proactive tools to change the outcome of your health. And I think what Josh has found, and Andrew Marr as well, and through all of your work too, is that this traumatic brain injury piece, until we can start to really claim that and understand the ramifications of post-concussive blasts, we're not going to be able to make all the positive interventions possible that are needed out there.
Right.
I've just done some research on the brain that's pretty, I didn't do the research, but there has been research that shows lymphatic tissue in the brain, and that's cutting edge new information. We didn't know that lymph existed in brain tissue. That adds a lot of credibility to inversions in yoga and why putting your legs up the wall helps physiologically change the chemistry and the feeling in the body, why it helps your immune system. So there's a lot of examples with yoga and with breathing and adaptive sports and nutrition. All of these things take that combination of education and then training to implement them.
And time.
And time. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that the application of this to something like archery is genius, because it's kind of like we said at the beginning, because it archery is a skill, and you have to be very disciplined in your approach to it. It's a practice. And so when you apply this type of thing to, you know, anything that requires a discipline, I think that introduces a routine in somebody's life, and it mm-hmm. gives them a ritual that they've got to practice, you know, regularly, that helps them to get outside of their mind, get outside of their thoughts. And I think that's the beauty of this, because if you go up to most guys and you say, hey, you're out now, you just got your DD214, let's go to yoga class, or let's go to this meditation retreat, it's not going to fly, you know what I mean? But if you say, hey, you know, let's go practice our shooting, or hey, let's go practice some archery, or hey, let's go roll some jujitsu or something like that, then that introduces that other element. It helps them to continue that discipline after that they're really craving, and helps to introduce some camaraderie, especially if they're doing it around other people. So
absolutely. It makes my job so much easier. It's terrifying to go into a yoga studio with a bunch of veterans that don't buy in, that want nothing to do with you. And, you know, I have the buy-in. I've been doing this lifestyle for over 20 years. I know the benefits. I want to share them, but it has to be, you know, offered in a way that's down to earth and practical and useful in their lives. And I think that's true for everything. But it is super fun to have Josh's help and to have archery behind me to help me kind of coyote at least the breathing in. And then we play with some yoga, some stretching for archery specifically. And it's a learning process to figure out what's going to work best.
Have you, Oh, go ahead, Josh. No, you go ahead, man.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the thing is it takes, oh man. So you're only supposed to build a brain once, you know, kind of going back to what you said and piggybacking onto what Emily said, but the amount of time and effort it took to build a brain was, you know, by most estimates, 27 years. And me and Em had been talking about, I kind of had an epiphany about it, you know, that she'd known a guy who had a severe, like, hard drive crash delete head injury, like full coma for a duration. And he said 17 years, he was just starting to get better. And you know, and what I really want to put out for other veterans is, I know you guys, if you're like me, you go to the doctor and they say, look, you got 6 months. 6 months and that damage is permanent. That is one of the worst things you could tell somebody who's got any sort of head injury, PT, oh, 6 months, you're dud. Which was really damaging for me to hear, because I was having difficulty, you know, trying to reconcile living a life that, you know, had become something so different from where I was that it was difficult to even accept that. And so what I found is that, you know, the amount of time, you know, is probably relative to the amount of damage. And at 5 years in, like, I'm still just really starting to have improvement, in, in the things, you know, I forgot what I was talking about earlier. You know, that's pretty regular for me. You know, going from being able to memorize, you know, a whole list of serial numbers, or we'll just take the Jumpmaster nomenclature test. I learned that in 24 hours. I got 100%. I'd never seen the study guide before. And now I can't get numbers from one page to the next without having to go back and recheck them six times. So, you know, the amount of damage that guys can be experiencing, you know, is significant, and it requires significant effort and time to get it functioning again. But guys got to know, look, it can function again. You know, that is the main thing that I if I tell anybody anything, if any guys are out there, they're listening, you got a head injury, I know what the doctor said. I know, because I went to all of them. And they're saying, hey, you're done after 6 months to 2 years is the longest I heard. No. Like, but you have to focus 100% totally and completely on that. Everything I do now is with the intention of, you know, recovering from the injury. If it is not conducive to recovery, I don't do it. I'm for what works. I don't care what it is, you know? And so when we're talking about these archery and breathing retreats, like, it doesn't matter if you like archery. It doesn't matter if you like breathing. And as Emily likes to say, it works whether you want it to or not. You have to find something that you can stomach long enough to put the effort in that you need to rebuild. Your brain doesn't just rebuild itself.
Right.
A neuron is built of very specific materials that are hard to find, you know, in your food. You're not supposed to really be getting those. Your mom makes those and gives them to you. And then your body has this huge engine at a young age that can produce these very difficult, complex cells that take a long time to regenerate. And you know, you only have a couple of things that regenerate. That's your liver and your brain. And it takes a very specific set of circumstances to reboot that in the system and say, hey, build brain again. You know, and that's why when we talk about it's nutrition, it's breathing, meditation, it's yoga. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter that the person at the VA was unenthusiastic. If you just do what they're saying, because I mean, I did that stuff, you know, and every time I was like, what a waste of time. But it's working whether you want it to or not, you know, but you have to do things. And I think that what happens when you get injured is that everything goes away. Like step one, all right, no more jumping out of planes, homeboy. Okay, no more standing next to the breach. Okay, now you take my airborne pay, you take my dental pay. You know, I go take another job where, okay, well, you can't really write emails. Let's put you on a profile. Okay, now we're just going to fire you. You know, so that you just, everything gets taken away. All your responsibility, everything you have to do gets removed. And then how are you supposed to practice these very complex, I mean, you know, when we talk about emotions, you're really talking about a very specific chemical mixture in the brain that causes a reaction to, you know, eat, sleep, fuck. I mean, if you want to be completely simple about it. And so these emotional issues that we're being diagnosed with are physiological issues that can be changed over time. They are accessible. And it's not why should you. Like, I'm not going to tell anybody why. Here's why you should do this. I'm for what works. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you do something if you're, you know, hurt? We come up with these mind-blowing plans of, you know, daring feats of rescue and assaults and rushing into danger as a QRF. And we can't, you know, take that same effort towards, you know, optimizing everything we're doing in our life. Like, think about how you did things in the military.
Yeah.
You kept looking until you found a solution that was workable for everybody, even the weakest link, and you made it work. That's what we do. But for some reason, when we get out, we get doctors to tell us to stop doing that. And you know, it's rice bowl wars and ego that does that. And what I want to tell guys is, dude, don't ever stop looking for, that's how Andrew got better. That's how I found Andrew, to know what to look for to start getting better. You know, he showed me, and now my job is to show other people, because there's 339,000 guys that we know of. And if it's not 10 to one on that, I will eat my beret, you know, with a pack of MRE cheese on.
Well, this is the thing too. You mentioned the idea of getting out of the military and what people do when they get out of the military. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this narrative, you get out, you settle down into civilian life, and you just kind of blend in with the rest of the crowd. And I don't think anybody joined the military in the first place, at least not the guys probably I was around or you were around or anything like that. They didn't join to blend into anything, right? Mm-hmm. They wanted to stand out. They wanted to excel. And, you know, the thing is, when you get out and you go to the doctor's job is to alleviate your symptoms or try to help you with your symptoms. And to try to, try, if it's a trauma doctor, they're going to try and fix a bone or something like that. Right. We're actually good at fixing traumatic injuries, bodily injuries, right? We're not very good at fixing chronic disease. The most we can do with chronic disease is treat the symptoms. And again, if you start to look at traumatic brain injury as a chronic disease, as something that needs to be approached from multiple angles, then you know, you start to get a different perspective. But they're saying, you know, I have a chronic disease. I have ulcerative colitis. And my doctor has consistently tried to tell me that the medication is what's working, right? The nutrition aspect of this, you don't really need to pay attention to it because the medication should be working for you. And that's the message they're giving to people. That's the message I got when I first got diagnosed. They said, you know, don't worry about this other stuff. Take the medication and it'll hold off. But that didn't work. And, you know, I went through immense pain because of it. And, you know, I'm not saying that my doctors have ill intentions, but they're not educated in a way to prevent disease. They're not educated in a way to really cure disease. They're educated in a way to try to stave off symptoms.
It's an attack mode, which works in certain circumstances. But when we're talking about healing and therapeutic applications, it's kind of like the gut bacteria. They're subtle, they're microscopic, they're even invisible sometimes. And it's a huge force, like the breath. It's an enormous influencer on your mind, body state, and your physiology. You know, the way you breathe and the choices you make around your food and the way that you choose to live your lifestyle day in and day out, sleep, hydration, all these facets have this therapeutic kind of tone. So it's a harder sell for doctors, especially. They would much rather attack a symptom and see a quick result. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, I'm very careful with medications. I would never advise somebody, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to advise somebody to go off their meds. But we've had success through the CAMO program with participants getting off of these pretty harsh synthetic drugs that have these damaging side effects to our guts and to our serotonin levels over time that kind of cripple our body's own capacities at regeneration and renewal. And how exciting is it that the brain and the liver do regenerate? Mm-hmm. You know, the body has healing mechanisms. And if we can flip the word therapy even on its head and kind of tie that into just, you know, doing everything that works, that it's not a soft skill, that it's actually something very radical. You know, it's radical for somebody to take charge of their health and their lifestyle in that proactive way. That's really something I'm passionate about, is giving people tools that they can use at home when they're not in Aspen on a ski retreat, when they're not on a river rafting week, fly fishing and doing archery or whatever we get to do. My role is bringing in those tools at home that are going to make a long-term difference.
What is a very simple thing that maybe somebody who's listening to this could try at home right at the moment? Like what is this a very simple thing that they could do right now that could potentially help them to start?
You got to breathe through your nose, or as Josh and his friends have coined, the Ujjayi hole in yoga. It's your Ujjayi breath. So nasal breathing creates more suction and pressure and brings your breath deeper down into the lower lobes of your lungs. So you breathe through your nose and you let your belly move when you breathe. So even as we're talking and you're listening, you're breathing through your nose and your belly is moving out when you breathe in, and it's moving in when you breathe out. And that's enervating your digestive tract, that vagus nerve that runs through the entire spine down into the belly. That gut-brain connection is activated. So if you do nothing else after this podcast, then start to breathe through your nose, in and out. Breathe out your mouth if it's challenging at first. That's fine. And to just start to listen to your body's signals for when you're chest breathing. It's a really common pattern for all of us to start to breathe up high in the chest And that just exacerbates a stress response in the brain that's not always helpful. It's helpful in some situations, not others. So I guess that would be my first piece. What do you got, Josh? What would you tell people?
Well,
shoot some shit. Know,
I think the yeah, definitely use demolitions to calm down. If you have access to those, if you don't, which a lot of us don't anymore. You know, I think that perfectly describes that indicator I had, was that heavy chest breathing, because I'd learned the one that I used after, you know, Emily had coached me that one time. She taught me what she called the box breath. It's just breathing in, holding for two, in for 4 seconds, hold for 2 seconds, out for four, hold for two. And that just calms your breathing, slows your heart rate. And I'd picked that one up at that, you know, camp, and I was going to a tournament in Las Vegas, and it was my first, you know, archery tournament. I was so nervous that every time I would think the word Vegas, literally just the word Vegas, I would get so much, you know, I would get so fired up that I couldn't even practice. And I noticed I was breathing in my chest, and I would, you know, do this box breathing in and out with the belly button and the four in, two hold, four out, two hold. And that would lower my heart rate. It would stop my hands, you know, from being unsteady. And really, I mean, when you're aiming, you got 0.02 degrees, I think, to hit the X, you know, if your hands are moving, that you can't, I couldn't even practice, you know? So, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of anything to have a detrimental effect, but it's very easy to, you know, move things and I am always thinking about optimization. Like, I want this race car to perform how I want this race car to perform. If I was shooting a bow or riding a bike, I would have it set up exactly how I want. You know, if I was going into combat, I would put my gun truck with the weapons arrayed in a way that they are most, you know, conveniently usable for me, that I can fire them in 360. You know, every consideration I would make, you know, would be conducive to performance. And, you know, that breathing, that simple little breathing tool, again, like, why should you? Why wouldn't you? Because if you're going to be good at anything, you have to attend to every single detail of the performance of that specific task. And you're going to need oxygen to do it. Mm-hmm. And as your brain gets more and more task saturated, like, you know, you've been in, you know, military training, it's task saturation. Mm-hmm. You start to breathe differently. Guys react differently. And as they have more stress piled upon them until they're trained, you know, you'll see a degradation of their decision-making ability, their physical ability to do what they need to do. And a lot of it can probably stem from the fact that they're not just, you know, let me think about this for a second and reacting. But we do it without knowing we're doing it in the military. You know, the fantastic thing that me and Em were talking about earlier was that somehow, and I don't know how we manage it, but without any of these tools, we are able to perform at this high level in the military. And so I start to think about, like, how is that possible? Well, maybe we weren't performing at the high level we thought we were performing. Maybe we're just performing a little bit higher level than, you know, I guess the rest of the world. We're still, I'm pretty sure, GWAT world champs. Has that changed? No.
So I think, you know, that's an important, powerful point. I mean, Josh and I were having a lively conversation about responding in general. It doesn't really matter if you're an extreme athlete or you're in the military or whatever, it gives you a chance to respond. Or right now for Josh, it's archery. For me, it was whitewater kayaking. Something that puts your body and mind in that, you know, possibility to have a flow state experience. And the mind will tell the body how to breathe in those states. It'll do it for you. You are called to attend to your highest optimal state possible because you don't have the bandwidth to process anything. You're in the moment. So for me, if it's a class 4 river, I'm in that moment. I'm not going to be thinking about my to-do list or some conversation that bummed me out. And it's an amazing thing to experience as a human. And I think it's really important in performance or healing to find something that gives you a chance to practice that state. And then of course the breath can become an advantage to that state. And in the breath work that we're doing, we're training people how to use the breath to kind of cultivate a state that you have access to when you need it. So there's training time, just like what you do in archery or anything else, and when you're training to get proficient at something. But then there's the acute skills that you need when something goes wrong. So if you're having an anxiety attack, there are specific breath patterns that you can use, but you're not likely to use them if you haven't trained.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things I've done with jujitsu is before I roll, I'll do some box breathing on my own. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, I get a lot less time. I mean, I do a lot of conditioning work. I do a lot of like training, but I get a lot less tired and end up not doing the freaky breathing that a lot of people do while we're doing the live rolling. I still suck. I'm a white belt, but I find that doing breathing exercises and actually focusing on my breathing beforehand really helps me to stay in a state of mind where I'm not freaking out if somebody's, you know, trying to smother me or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And so I try to say it's like the tail wagging the dog. The breath can wag the nervous system. You have a master switch. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few automatic nervous system functions you can control. So it's awesome that you have that as a metric, and everybody can relate to that in some form or another. It's just, there are a few that are like Josh that are going to apply it and find out that it works and then use it to their advantage. And I think that's the message we both want to send out, is like, take advantage of tools that work. And if they don't work for you, that's okay. We're not here to sell anything. This is like, get well in the ways that you can, perform at your best so that, you know, life can improve. And then for both of us, we've noticed when we are, you know, at our best, the result is that you have more for your family. You have more time at work, more space to accomplish the things that you're setting out for in life. So it's not just about feeling good. It's about functioning really well and performing at a level that you can not just feel good about, but that you can improve the lives of the people around you that you care about. So
that's awesome. You know,
so the thing that, you know, really like that philosophy that draws me to this is, you know, I think about, and you know, anybody who's been to combat's going to know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, we don't like this. I want more to sacrifice and give to my brothers. You know, these are the people that I care more about than myself. And if I can do anything to tip the balance into my favor so that I can do more for them, like, it's not, why should I, why wouldn't I, you know, I'm going to take every single event I always have. And I've never, you know, fought with anybody that has done anything but that. We are all 100% focused and committed. And, you know, it's such a beautiful thing to see this team operate, you know, teams of any type of military unit, you know, operate in such harmony, you know, a group of guys so committed to each other that instead of running away from the guns, they run to the guns. Like, you know, where do we find such people? And that is born of a commitment by each person in that unit to be as good as they can possibly be. And that the other people around you, you know, okay, that guy is going to do what he said he's going to do, which is cover my ass, because I know that he's done everything. I trust him implicitly, completely, you know, whether it's giving him a $10,000 bill and asking him to take it to the bank, or if it's, you know, standing up to give me some covering fire to go, you know, take a crap or whatever. I don't know, whatever, you know, your buddy did for you that, you know, is putting you in front of him. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, so amazing. And, but,
yeah, I think that's a really important thing, man, because, you know, I think just being in service to others, it gives you a purpose and it gives you a reason for doing everything you're doing, you know, and a lot of people, they think to themselves, all right, I'm in the civilian world now. I don't have to be in service to others or anything like that, but you lose something from that. And it takes away a little bit of your purpose for getting up every morning. And so one of the things I tell people is that, you know, that mentality of, you know, covering for your brothers, that doesn't end. in the civilian world, if you're a veteran who is out there and you become successful, you becoming successful is a win for all of us. Your story is a win for all of us. And you have to remember that you getting up every day, you continuing to breathe, you putting 100% into what you're going to be doing here in the civilian world is helping all of us out. And it's putting you in service to your brothers, and to everybody who's ever worn a uniform, because all of us are sick of hearing about the suicides. All of us are sick about hearing about the bad stuff, and we need some good stories. We need some good civilian leaders here in this country. And I think that the veteran community can do that. We just need to continue to answer the call.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing there is that losing the job and the brotherhood and everything like that, that's not the end of the people that need you. You know, I mean, the skills that, you know, are acquired in the military, the, you know, cultural understanding of, you know, the world and how important and special what we have is, you know, is not fully appreciated until, you know, it's fully appreciated. And it takes an effort to become that way. And being the type of person that, you know, has that appreciation needs to get spread, you know. And we are always, you know, kind of called the same way. I think, you know, you don't stop being needed when you get out. It can feel that way, but your family needs you or your friends need you. You know, there's always, you know, something to work and strive for. I mean, that's how you made it. Even if you were the biggest dirtbag in the 1st Infantry Division, you know, you still went to Iraq and you still did your year. You know, you still did what you had to do. And maybe, you know, you don't like that guy, but maybe he needs you, you know, to do something for him that he can't do for himself. And if, you know, we don't do it, nobody's going to do it.
Absolutely.
You know, you got a purpose, is what I'm saying.
Definitely. I agree 100%. I wanted to ask you guys before we start to sign off, how can people get in touch with you? Where can they go to find you, and how can they become involved?
Well, two things. The first is Challenge Aspen Military Opportunities is where Josh and I met and where we continue to do some really great work together. We have 3 archery camps already on the calendar for next summer. And so you can go to challengeaspen.org to either apply for, I think we have 20 different adaptive sports camps this year. Wow. And spaces are filling quickly. So that program is expanding, and I encourage people to apply to come out here and join us for those. You can donate, you can volunteer at Challenge Aspen. Every ounce of energy that goes into that organization turns around and changes lives. It's one of the most efficient, well-run nonprofits I've ever seen or been a part of. So I'm really proud of what they're doing, and our role there is really exciting. And then the second thing is sort of a mystery. Josh and I are co-creating what we're calling Guerrilla Holistic, and we do have a website. You can go there and sign up, and we will be in touch when we know what the hell we're doing. But for now, it's about spreading our knowledge and information to the people that we care about that need it, and evolving programs when we're ready to do that. So Josh, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah. In addition to a couple of things I'd like to tell people. Number one, if you're not involved in your military adaptive sports program, if you're out, your Army Wounded Warrior rep should be able to put you in contact with somebody who can get you involved. And if you're hurt, you know, there's certain things you got to do to get better. That's pretty much step 1 through 10 is getting involved in something. There's already a program established. Military Adaptive Sports in each service has a branch and a program, and you can get into whatever archery or whatever you want to get into. You can get into it there. It doesn't matter what's wrong with you. I got friends with one hand left, and they golf, they shoot bows, seated volleyball, wheelchair basketball, wheelchair rugby. I mean, there is no adaptation that I've seen that hasn't, you know, worked. There is something I've got a buddy who's a quadriplegic that rides a hand bike. So if he can get out there and get on his hand bike, you you guys need to also. And I'll caveat that by saying, you know, you got to do something. I'm just saying, guys, you have to pick something and do it. Even if it's not military depth of sports, you find something, because all the guys that didn't make it home, you know, don't have that opportunity. Your job now is to get better, find something, you know, get a hold of us, get a hold of Warrior Angels. If you're special operations, look at Task Force Dagger, you know, talk to your Army Wounded Warrior rep, get involved, do something. One of the other options that I'm personally involved with is the Disabled Veterans Archery Assistance Program. You can find them at dvaap.org. Fill out an application for our program. We're going to take, I think, 60 vets to archery tournaments this summer. We'll give you gear, the whole nine yards. Also, the CAMO program, both for, I mean, they do skiing, blacksmithing, archery now, three camps this year we'll do. I'd love to do more. And if there's a big enough need, we'll do as many as they'll let us do. And so if you guys are looking for something, definitely get a hold of any one of those people and do something, because, you know, they're watching.
Awesome.
That's awesome, Josh.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you know, all of you out there, and I say this every week, but what you got to understand here is that each and every one of you, you have a choice every day. And your choice is to look at the world around you and see chains and constraints, or to look at the world around you and to see opportunity. And each and every day brings the opportunity for that choice. And each and every choice you make feeds into this. So when Josh says you got to do something, it means you got to do something. You got to get out there. You've got to fight to make sure that you're living your best life. And so every day, get up, get your clothes on, make that decision. Make the most out of your time here, because there's a lot of guys who couldn't come back to have that choice. So with that, to the Warrior Soul audience, thank you for listening. Now get out there and live your best lives.